Welcome to UEG Podcast, where we talk about scientific discoveries, educational insights, and professional development within the world of digestive health. Whether you're a clinician, researcher, or just passionate about GI content, this is the podcast for you.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the UEG podcast. My name's Pradeep Mundry. I am a gastroenterologist from the UK. I'm a podcast host for UEG. Welcome to this another episode where we cover a lot of basics on a particular topic. Today, we're going to discuss about MASLD, metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease. And the discussion will be centered around what a general gastroenterologist or a trainee or a primary care physician or a general practitioner needs to know about MASLD. And to discuss that, today we have our guest, Professor Sven Frank, Professor of Gastroenterology and Hepatology from Antwerp University Hospital, Belgium. Sven has made huge contribution in the field of MASLD as a clinician, researcher, and an educator. And he's one of the authors for the latest EASL/Multi-Society guidelines on MASLD published in 2024. On behalf of UEG, welcome for this conversation, Sven.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Pradeep, and happy to join.
Thanks, Sven. We're going to try and do this in two parts. And part one, where we try to cover the basics, the diagnosis, and monitoring. And part two will cover the treatment, future directions, and the latest in this. So, Sven, let's start with the basics in terms of prevalence. We all know that the prevalence is increasing and hugely increasing compared to various other diseases. And this is a modern day disease. Maybe if you can shed some light on what is the scale of the increase in prevalence and how would it affect us in the future, of how bad it is?
Well, it obviously has to do with the pathophysiology of the disease, which is closely linked to mainly dysfunctional adiposity. That's really one of the key. And then diabetes is also an important factor in disease progression. The estimates are, because I'm saying it's estimates, because still the gold standard or the best standard for the diagnosis, specifically for the more severe subtype of steatohepatitis, is based on liver biopsy. And of course, we do not have population-based data with liver biopsy. But the estimates are that roughly 30-35% of the adult population has steatotic liver disease, mainly MASLD. Luckily, it's not in all those patients truly a progressive liver disease. It's a sign of being metabolically unhealthy, but not necessarily an advanced liver disease. But of those 30-35%, the estimates are that roughly 20-25% will have steatohepatitis and a risk of progression to fibrosis, which means that between 5-7% of the adult population has MASH, and the percentage evolving to cirrhosis is also there within about 20%. That the estimate over time, because this disease takes long before it develops to advanced chronic liver disease and cirrhosis. So, but given the evolution over time, we will face a huge burden. We already facing the burden, but the burden will increase because of the natural history of the disease.
And so do you see that in your own practice, the kind of patients that you're seeing and the amount of hepatologists you're employing in your own hospital dealing with this disease?
It's clearly increasing. Of course, in a first year referral center, you're getting a selection of patients. And as this is a chronically evolving disease, probably evolving more slowly than, for example, viral hepatitis or alcohol-related liver disease, we start now to see an increasing number of those patients, also because it's not still that easy to know who exactly has to take care of those patients. So it has already become a quite substantial proportion of our patients. It's clearly increasing. Also, when you go to the more extreme side and end-stage liver disease needing liver transplantation, it's clearly increasing in terms of the proportion of patients that we're seeing.
Okay, Sven. So thanks for clarifying that. Let's move to terminology, Sven. The guidelines are very clear in this. Just for our audience, can you clarify what each of the terminology means and what is the umbrella term and what do you mean by metal, you know, mash and all those things, just in brief.
So in the past, we talked about non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, meaning there is fatty liver and it's not alcohol. So it was a little bit a basket term for everything that was not related to alcohol or known reasons of steatosis. It was, of course, at really in that terminology, mainly related to metabolic dysfunction. But now in the new nomenclature, it's clear. We start from the observation that there is liver steatosis. And then under that umbrella, you have a long list of causes of steatosis. But the main causes in daily practice are, of course, metabolic dysfunction on the one hand and the use of alcohol on the other hand. If you have alcohol consumption, which is above the thresholds that we use to define alcohol consumption non-alcoholic, then it's the combination of both. So even if under the umbrella you have a long list of potential causes, the most prevalent ones are metabolic or alcohol or the combination of both, and that's then the MET-ALD.
So what you're trying to say is, Sven, is there's this big umbrella term called steatotic liver diseases, and in that you have ALD, MASH. But you're also trying to say that there are other causes of steatotic liver diseases, not just alcohol and MASLD.
No, it can be drug-induced. You have some specific genetic mutations. Of course, genetic mutations play also a role in MASLD and in alcohol-related liver diseases, you know, but you have specific called monogenic diseases that also cause steatosis. So I think the advantage of the umbrella term is that it forces you to think of all different risk factors for chronic liver disease that might coincide in one given patient, and not just saying, okay, this patient is drinking alcohol, so his liver steatosis is alcohol-related liver disease. No, you have to think of all potential causes of steatosis and all potential causes of chronic liver disease that can coexist. And of course, some of them are more prevalent and others are more rare diseases, but at least you have to have that reflex that it's not the first cause you identify is not always explaining the whole picture.
In the guidelines, Sven, I think there's a really beautiful flow chart which kind of guides people like me to kind of come to a conclusion, and it's really, really beautifully written, and I really advise the listeners to go and look at this flowchart. It's really lovely and very succinct.
Yeah, and you can also find it in the EASL Guidelines app, which is also very practical to have it in your pocket.
Yes. So let's talk about the pathophysiology. So you have fat deposits in the hepatocytes. So what happens, you know, what happens eventually? What did that cause? How long does it take to progress into other things such as fibrosis, cirrhosis? Can you briefly delineate, just so that we can understand how, let's say, pharmacological treatment works?
First of all, it's very important to understand that this is largely driven, first of all, by, as I mentioned early on, by dysfunctional adiposity. So it all starts there, and then there is spillover to ectopic fat deposition in other organs, including the liver, but also spillover of inflammatory mediators and other mediators that also drive liver disease. And then in the liver, once you have, first of all, that lipid accumulation, you get lipotoxicity, you get mitochondrial dysfunction. There are a bunch of pathways that are altered directly by the lipid accumulation, indirectly by other mediators coming from the adipose tissue and the systemic chronic inflammation. And on top of that, of course, you have all the mechanisms the liver is equipped with to cope with that, or the lack thereof. So it's a very complex pathophysiology that both includes dysfunctional adipose tissue and then all the liver pathophysiological pathways and the abilities of the liver to cope with that and to defend itself, which explains the large heterogeneity in the patients, where you can have metabolic risk factors and despite that no liver disease, and on the other hand relatively minor metabolic risk factors and still having quite progressive liver disease. on average, the evolution is slow. The estimates are that in terms of stage of fibrosis progression, we usually use a classification that stages the disease from 0 to 4, so with 5 stages. The estimates are that you need about 6-7 years to go from one stage to the next one if you have underlying steatohepatitis. If you do not have steatohepatitis, there can still be some progression, but it's way slower. So it takes you 15, 20 years, sometimes 30 years or longer, to evolve from no fibrosis to advanced fibrosis and cirrhosis. So on average, it's a very slowly evolving, but evolving disease.
But do all the patients progress to
In that big group of, as I mentioned, the estimates are 30-35% of the adult population. Luckily, the majority will not evolve towards steatohepatitis and not towards end-stage liver disease. That's, in percentages, a relative minority, of course, given the large numbers of patients. It still represents a large number of people, but it's only a few percentages that in the end will evolve to cirrhosis. As I said, about 1 out of 4 of the patients with steatosis have steatohepatitis with a clear risk of fibrosis progression.
Is there anything within the baseline characteristics which would predict the risk of progression? Are there any particular subset of patients within the MASH who are high risk of progression to cirrhosis at all, so that we're aware, you know, which ones to look out for?
Well, there are a few factors. We still are facing that heterogeneity with the patients there. The issue of difference between men and women.
Okay.
So women are relatively protected until the menopause, but after the menopause, there's an accelerated progression of the disease. Men are a little bit at risk at earlier ages. So that's one component. Visceral adiposity clearly is a risk factor. So it's not just BMI, it's how the body composition is, and abdominal fat accumulation is clearly more vulnerable. The presence of diabetes is for sure a risk factor, a very important risk factor for more aggressive fibrosis progression. Clinically, that are the most prominent factors. We have some genetic mutations that have an influence on the disease progression. To date, with the limited implications, that's not something for routine clinical practice, but in the future, that might also be something that helps us to better risk stratify the patients.
Thanks for explaining that, Sven. At least that'll help us to, at least the primary care physicians or general gastroenterologists, to maybe monitor these patients more than the other, at least risk stratify them. Based on that, what more to the patients who were labeled as MASLD with a normal body mass index, sort of non-obese, different? Are there any ethnic factors into consideration while sticking to this? Because, you know, when I was a trainee, for me, MASLD was... the obesity was the key factor in MASLD, but that doesn't seem to be the case completely.
No, that's not completely the case. Also because, I mean, our understanding of obesity is also evolving, and then that's why the obesity physicians now insist on clinical obesity and on dysfunctional adiposity rather than a pure BMI-based approach. And it's not just obesity. Also, people living with overweight have already a clearly increased risk. And some of the people with class 3 obesity are not always as steatotic as you would expect. So it's really about dysfunctional adiposity and not so much about weight. And with this said, what we see in those, what you could call lean MASLD, although I do not like the terminology at all, and I think we should not use it. Most of these people do have some visceral fat accumulation and some dysfunctional adiposity and insulin resistance. So they are not metabolically healthy, despite the fact that, according to the criteria, they do not have overweight. It's typically something we see in people from Asian descent. There it's something that is more frequently encountered than in most of the other ethnicities. But still, even if people have normal weight according to the BMI, BMI criteria, they usually have visceral adipose tissue accumulation and dysfunction and insulin resistance that explains the occurrence of MASLD, even if they are not overweight.
Sven, coming to the practical management, you know, the way I come across such patients is, you know, when I'm investigating them for other diseases, they get incidentally find transaminitis or transient raised ALT, which is persistent. That's when I suspect. Or you do a CT scan or ultrasound scan for some other reason, and that shows imaging abnormality suggestive of fatty liver. So you suspect MASLD in these patients. What's your workup like normally in your practice? What do you do with such patients? You know, either radiological evidence of steatosis or persistently raised liver enzymes in the absence, let's say, of other etiology that would explain these liver enzyme abnormalities, plus in the presence of these risk factors.
Yeah, you're touching already on a very important point, I think, Pradeep. If you have a chronically elevated transaminases, there are, of course, several causes that we need to exclude. So even if you have steatosis, you should think of excluding viral hepatitis and autoimmune hepatitis, etc. But if that is done in the scenarios that you mentioned, I mean, probably not in a hepatology clinic, but in a more general setting with lower prevalence of advanced disease, FIB4 is a good starting test. So it's an easy test based on AST, ALT, platelets, and the age of the patients. It's not reliable below the age of 35. And as age is part of it, you also need to have different cutoffs when people get to the age of 65. But it's a very good starting point because it has a very high negative predictive value. The positive predictive value is not good. So you cannot use it as a positive diagnostic tool, but you can use it to reliably exclude the presence of significant fibrosis, because that's the target which corresponds to the F2 on the 0 to 4 scale. So calculating the FIB4, and if it's below 1.3, then you can reassure the patient at least to say, okay, you do not have, or there's a very low likelihood that you have significant fibrosis. It still means that you're metabolically unhealthy, so you need to work on the metabolic comorbidities for sure. But in terms of viewing it from pure liver perspective, with such a low FIB4, you can reassure the patient and just make sure that there is some follow-up in the future, because of course the risk can evolve. When you have a high FIB4, which means that the threshold is 2.67, then there is an increased likelihood of the presence of fibrosis. So that needs then referral at least for a second line test to confirm or deny that first result. And if you are in between, then the guideline also gives you two options. There's still metabolic risk factors you can work on. You can intensify the management of those metabolic comorbidities and then reevaluate after six months or 1 year. Or you can also go straight ahead, because you're in the gray zone, to a second line test. Okay. But all that applies to a setting where you have a relatively low prevalence of advanced disease, because that kind of screening test works well.
Okay, so that's the primary care setting, or in a gastroenterology clinic,
obesity clinic. That's a perfect tool there to do a first screening.
Excellent. So to summarize this one, so I see patients with hepatic steatosis on imaging or persistently raised liver enzymes. I exclude other diseases and they fit into the criteria for diagnosis. And again, I would advise the listeners to go through the guidelines. There's a good flow chart to make a diagnosis of MASLD. I do a FIB4 test at baseline and risk stratify them based on the number, and then follow them up depending on the risk. So I want to just quickly dwell into the middle range, the intermediate range FIB4 test. You mentioned intensified management of comorbidities. That's not just, you know, a bit of dietary therapy, a bit of exercise. So you're suggesting that you can go more into that. Treatment for obesity, medical treatment, surgical treatment and all that. Is that what you mean by intensified management of comorbidities?
It's a little bit of both, because what is sometimes very helpful is, we all know that lifestyle modification is easily said, but it's not so easy to implement it in daily life, even if patients are motivated to do so. if you know that there is a risk of having more advanced liver disease, with the appropriate support, people can change their lifestyle. So that already is an important step. But if that's insufficient, or if that's not something that is likely to be very successful, I think indeed you need to think about the management of obesity with more than just lifestyle modification. There are now several drugs that are highly efficacious to treat obesity. As you mentioned, bariatric surgery, I think it's still something we need to include in the armamentarium within the proper indications. But if there is an indication of the presence of liver disease, I think it should add to the medical indication to at least consider bariatric surgery in the spectrum of other options, of course.
Sven, let's go through the patient journey. You know, such patients come to me and I'm just doing this FIB4 test. I manage them intensively. At what point do you as a specialist hepatologist want to get involved? What should be the threshold for referral to the hepatologist, so to say, hepatologic clinic?
Well, I think you have two possible scenarios. The first one is already when you have that high FIB4, then there needs to be a confirmatory test. And then it depends a little bit on how the healthcare system is organized, who is going to perform or ask for that second line test. That if you have tests like liver stiffness measurements readily available, tests like ELF readily available, then that can also be asked by the one who did the first screening. If that test comes also back positive, I think definitely the patient needs to be seen in a hepatology clinic. In other healthcare systems where those the access to those second line tests is probably a little bit more limited, then they should more quickly go to the level where those second line tests are available. If you are in the intermediate category, I think that intensification of the treatment with lifestyle and, as you said, obesity care is very important. But then you should make sure that you re-evaluate the risk of the presence of significant fibrosis. And if on re-evaluation you're still in the gray zone or even above the threshold, then that's also the patient that needs to be seen in a hepatology clinic.
Okay, good. And with the liver stiffness, the FibroScan, you know, at least wherever hospitals are worked in, we have very easy access to these. How is the access in rest of Europe? Is it easy for clinicians to access these tests? And if they don't have access, let's say, to a FibroScan or ELF test, is there any other way to get that information, whether they have advanced fibrosis or not?
I think the situation in Europe is very different from one country to another. I think the availability of FibroScan has substantially increased in most of the countries. For ELF, the pattern is quite diverse. Of course, FibroScan is not the only tool we have for liver stiffness measurement. There is 2D shear wave elastography, for example, also present, which can be added to a normal classical ultrasound.
Okay.
We have less data in terms of validation within the mesalt space, but I assume that it's an equally valid tool to assess liver stiffness. So you have that as an alternative. Of course, there's also MR elastography, but there the availability is, in Europe at least, throughout Europe, rather limited. So I think a liver stiffness measurement and or ELF are tools that we really need to develop further in places where this is still not readily available, because they are very important tools to avoid the need for a liver biopsy. A liver biopsy still has its place, for sure, but it requires a high level of expertise for a correct interpretation, and obviously it's also a more risky procedure. So we need those non-invasive tools absolutely to have a proper patient trajectory and only reserve that procedure for those who really need it.
So Sven, talking about liver biopsy, just to end the part one of this conversation, when do you use liver biopsy in your practice for MASLD patients? Because it looks like we're moving away and we're just using non-invasive tests and things and
yeah.
Even diagnosing, yeah.
Yeah, and I think in routine clinical practice, you can go a long way with the non-invasive tests. Of course, you will have instances where, first of all, you still remain doubtful about, is this just a pure MASLD case or is there another etiology? So some patients will have some autoantibodies that are positive or might take drugs that cause steatosis. So you might be in doubt about the underlying etiology, and then a liver biopsy is for sure very useful. You might also have a situation where your non-invasive tests come back with discrete results, and then because identifying advanced fibrosis and cirrhosis has an impact on the management of the patient, then you can still also argue that a liver biopsy is needed. And then, of course, if patients are potential candidates for clinical trials, the clinical trials are still based on the liver biopsy for phase 3 at this time point. So there, definitely, you still need the liver biopsy. Also, that is probably something that will change in the upcoming years. But for the time being, that's not the case.
Thanks, Sven. I think we would conclude the part one of this discussion. We discussed about the diagnosis, practical aspects of managing a patient and a non-specialist, and how would you monitor and when would be referral to the specialist hepatologist. And thanks once again.
Okay. Thank you.
We do.
Thanks for listening to UEG Podcast. We hope you found some new ideas, insights, and inspiration to take with you. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you like our content, please leave us a review and share our podcast with your colleagues.